for everybody.
We were talking also about that blend of comedy and seriousness here. Are you satisfied now with the kind of blend that you have?
Well, I am. Yeah, I'm fairly satisfied. I am fairly satisfied with the blend in the kind of the warmth, the honest emotion. Those are all things that were mostly to be found and fulfilled within the jokes, between the jokes, and outside of a couple of scenes which were specifically designed for that. What we didn't want to do was go along at this incredible, this breakneck pace and then hit those couple of scenes and do them and make it appear as though, okay, folks, now we're doing the warmth, and then go back and just be totally crazy. So what we tried to do, find little places where we could kind of plant it before and after, and you know, throughout the picture, and I think it works pretty well. It's
Were we a good audience last night?
Well, I didn't think that it played as well as it has played in our previews with paying audiences and, mm-hmm. and you know.
How many previews have you had with general audiences, and have you been there? And
yeah, I've always been there. I've always been there.
What sort of
we had three. We had three paying previews, and I ran it about a dozen times as I was cutting, where you would just get 75 people or 100 people to come in. Kind of, it helps you hear where the laughs are and aren't, and kind of cut accordingly. The thing that last night's audience did was laugh at a lot of jokes that no one else ever gets. There were three or four that I always kind of cracked me up, and it never gets much of a reaction. I've always left them in because I liked them.
Which one?
Well, there's one in particular because it came toward the end of the picture, and so that's the reason I can remember it specifically. But when the guy comes out and says, "Hey, where the fuck is 4K?" and that whole exchange, and Henry says, "I'd like a new sandwich, and there's mustard on this." And the guy says, "So?" And Henry says, "This is egg salad." Now, that's kind of funny to me. And it got a good laugh last night.
Yeah.
And that's the very, very first time it's gotten a laugh.
Hmm.
And yet some of the other kind of broader physical stuff was not going over as well last night as it normally does.
Parker Meridian Hotel got a laugh.
Yes.
Yeah. You know why?
No, why?
We all stay there.
Oh, I see. We were looking at each other behind the panel. Yeah, we were real funny on that one, weren't we? We pull that one off. Well, that's all in the execution, is it?
Maybe 2 weeks ago, right?
There does come a time, though, when you cannot cut anymore.
No, right.
Obviously. Okay.
Right.
How frustrating can that get in your own experience as a filmmaker?
Well, I came across, I was talking to, I can't claim the quote. It's a real good quote. Alan Davier, the guy who shot E.T., having dinner with him the other night.
Harry Trace.
Right, that's right. He did. And he said something that I really think makes all the sense in the world, that no film is ever finished, it's only abandoned. And
I think he stole it from someone, too.
Well, probably. He may have. But it makes a lot of sense. And I know I was feeling that yesterday as we were dubbing, and it was 8:03, and the Al Jarreau song was just going in, and you know, I mean, there comes a time when the picture, you got to have these deadlines, and there are things that, you know, I'd love to fiddle around with it some more, but I don't really think that, I might make the picture a little better for me, but I don't think I'd be able to make any real substantial changes that would increase audience response, or particularly, or do anything really substantive.
Any surprises for you on the set or in the post-production?
Well, the biggest surprise for me was I didn't really feel we had any big laughs. I didn't think we had any real, you know, major laughs. Where like I thought we had a string of chuckles and kind of charming little moments and things like that. But I didn't think we'd have situations where you wouldn't be able to hear the next couple lines. And we have, like, you know, five or six of those in the movie. That's probably the biggest surprise.
So the previews were good in terms of, you know, the pacing.
The previews were fantastic, and you know, the picture, even when it was 2 hours and 15 minutes and I was playing it, it was playing well. It just sagged badly in the middle, and we started cutting it and cutting it and cutting it, and always handing out those cards and getting response and doing callbacks and really, really paying attention, because this is an audience pleaser. I mean, that's what you got to be shooting for. And you're kidding yourself if you don't take into consideration what is going to work. It's got to work.
Have you changed your attitudes towards what does work in terms of a film audience versus, say, a television audience?
Well,
for the same laughs.
No, I really haven't, because some of the jokes that we all said, gee, it's pretty TV, isn't it? It's a real TV joke in its construction. And we hung on to it because we thought, well, maybe at least it's a good TV joke, and let's try it, and then see, would get good reactions. So,
what do you consider a TV joke?
Totally. We did a lot. We have a lot of setup jokes, like a real good laugh that we always get is using the morgue cars, and he says, "It's a limo, isn't it?" And Henry says, "It's a limo for dead people." And he says, "Did you see that kid?"
Yeah.
Now, that's about as joke as you can get. Now, Michael's execution is real good, but it always works. And we said, you know, we're looking at it on the page. You say, well, there's a joke. That's going to just leap out like you're really begging. But it works. Is this a great country or what?
Yes, yes.
You know, Henry goes through a long speech. My hair is falling out. My gums are bleeding. And strange men are rolling around in bed with these women. And we're making money from that. And it's it's an absolute, it's a constructed joke. But as the writers always say, when we would talk about that, they'd say, well, you know, I think funny is funny.
Was this a script that was floating around?
No. No, it was Brian Grazer, the producer, had this idea. He got it out of the New York Times. Two guys were running this prostitution ring out of the morgue. He thought it was kind of a funny idea. He kicked around with it for a while. It was never developed. He talked to me about it one day. I thought it was kind of interesting, although pretty risky, you know, and I wasn't sure about it. Then he suggested that we go to Lowell Gans, who I had worked with, who's from Odd Couple and Happy Days, created Laverne and Shirley. And I've been bugging Lowell that it was time for him to do features. He's just one of the brightest guys that I know, and he's genuinely can write funny. Lowell liked the idea, brought in his partner, Babalu. And you can imagine. Right. And they were really able to break the story very well, kind of create that Odd Couple sort of feeling, which was a change from the way the characters were in actuality and the way that Brian had conceived them. And took it one place, I think MGM or someplace, and then we took it to Laddie on a Friday, and on Monday they called up and gave us a development deal. Very inexpensive development deal by major standards, but he was buying the whole package. Brian as a producer, me as a director, and these guys to write the script, and let's see what we come up with. And they just always liked the script.
It's very well written.
It is well written. It is well written. And it's, and it,
they
also state. What?
There's actually some original jokes.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm glad to hear you say that. They were still working on some shows that they had to do. They had to follow up on, because Henry actually started working on the picture while Happy Days was still going, and so Lowell was producing this last year and Happy Days, and he had to stay with it. But I kept encouraging them to come around and help, and we continued to change things and rewrite things. And they were just great. We're working with them again. On another project, Atlanta.
Can we assume that your career as a director then is certainly on the rise? It's going to be continuing. It's a priority.
It's a priority for me, and it does seem to be on the rise. In that, I think first of all, getting hired by the ad company improved my stock quite a bit. It's a fairly prestigious company. Everyone has a lot of respect for Ladd, and the word of mouth around town has just been terrific on this picture. I don't really know exactly how that happened, except Laddie kept saying, "Why do you want to run this picture so many times? People are going to come and see it." And I kept, because I'd always done it. You know, I'd always run my pictures a million times as work print, black and white work prints I'd run. It didn't matter, because I figure if you could get it to kind of play that way, you know, you're on the right track. And he indulged me because we were in a big hurry, and I said, here's the way we can cut fast. Right away we know what to throw out, and that's good, you know. And but what I never realized was that people take pictures from the Ladd Company a little more seriously than they take pictures from Roger Corman in TV movies that I'm doing for NBC. Yeah. Nobody particularly wants to show up for those things. But the people were sneaking in and finding out about our little rough cut screenings and showing up, and it was all great. They'd call up Ladd the next day. They'd say, I think you got a hit there. It's a pretty good picture. And then he'd get on the phone. I mean, he was glad to hear that people liked it, but he said, "There's, you see, it's happening. It's happening. People are seeing the picture before it's ready." And they are really, you know, they try to play everything pretty close to the vest.
Yeah.
I think next time I would try to go take it somewhere to do that. I still think it's essential. But, yeah, I wouldn't do them out of studio screening rooms anymore.
How conscious are you at this point of a kind of a style or certain things that you enjoy showing up film after film?
Well, I don't...
Sports jokes. Every time I see a sports joke in that movie, I sort of think, I wonder if that's...
Well,
you coming in there.
Michael is a sports fan, and Lowell Gans is a sports fan, and so I can, and I certainly have a lot of appreciation for sports jokes. So anytime a good one worked.
I mean, you're talking about a slam dunk.
Yeah.
Was, was that something that was all along in the conception?
It's slam dunk. That was exactly how it was pitched. We said, I said, why don't we have an opening? Why don't we not open with the characters? And let's make people think that they, like when they go to the multiplex, let's make them think they actually went to the wrong picture.
That's wonderful.
And then hopefully just about the time they're about ready to get really worried, then maybe have a joke. And so then we devised this sort of chase. It was a kind of a way to get to the morgue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with this chase. And then Lowell said, so what, did she get like thrown out a window or something? And I said, yeah, throw him out a window. That sounds pretty good. And he said, what, we should have a hoop down there? I said, yeah. And then we both kind of slam dunk. But no, I love sport. But I'm the only thing that I can pinpoint, and I don't think that I am probably introspective enough to be able to kind of predetermine what I would like to create as a consistency or a characteristic of my work as a director. But the only thing that I can see is that I do like to be ultimately positive about relationships, and I like to see people kind of getting along, and I like to see people who everyone is telling them that they can't do something, I like to see them pull something off. I mean, I wouldn't say that I would encourage people to go out and become pimps, but this is a pretty good thing that Chuck did.
It's kind of uncomfortable for me to ask this, but I'm aware of that concern, and I see it showing through in so much of the film. That's why in some other parts of the film, with some of the nudity
mm-hmm.
and things, it jars on me.
Right.
A little bit.
Right. Well, it became, I'll tell you, it's a question. It's a kind of a tricky question. This movie was probably going to get an R anyway because of the kind of picture it was. I mean, you're dealing with prostitution and so forth. Now, it's a feature, and when you're going out into the marketplace, would people feel cheated if you were doing a movie about prostitution and you totally skirted that? You never showed any nudity. Would they feel like, gee, they didn't want to be in bad taste, so they didn't do it? I don't know. It's a kind of a tricky theory. It's really hours and hours of discussion were put into this.
Did you shoot more than you showed?
Yes.
Because personally, I didn't think it wasn't jarring, but it could have been just
we shot more than we showed. We shot about twice as much as we shot.
The love scene, for example, or the orgy scene, or which?
Not the love scene. The morgue frat party. There's more nudity there. There was more nudity. When you're saying orgy, do you mean Paradise Found? The club at the end?
Actually, I did mean the frat party.
The frat party. Paradise Found, we had more nudity.
And the man in the pool there, is he the father of the fiancé? I thought I recognized him.
No, Joe Spinell.
Okay.
I
was wondering.
That's interesting.
Might
Jeez.
Have recurred.
Some people say that Richard Belzer, who's he's one of the bad guys.
Yeah.
A couple of people have said that they thought that was Henry.
Oh, it really looks like
him. Yeah, in the opening scene.
Which I didn't ever even occurred to me, but that's kind of interesting how things like that pop up.
Yeah.
It was something that...
You mean it wasn't conscious? The French critics are, very important political...
Actually, all right. I want to see that review. I want to see that analysis of Night Shift.
I'm sure that they will.
Well, have you had some European notices yet on any of your work?
No, I haven't.
I mean, the way they reacted to Jerry Lewis has caused a lot of consternation here.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're waiting...
No.
...preemptively.
No.
Let's go back to this question of what's tasteful. Whether or not you get an R rating or what have you.
Right.
But just a question of how much is too much and wrestling with that idea. Does that intrigue you?
Well, it became kind of a group decision. You know, on the one hand, Brian, the producer, very hip kind of guy, might have actually opted for a little bit more. I think that I probably shot a little less than he would have liked, but it was fine, you know. And Laddie was concerned about it and didn't want us to overdo it. And if we'd have had, all it would have really taken was, you know, if Laddie had said, geez, need a few more tits. I mean, let's talk turkey here, boys. Why, we would have done that. Because we're glad to be making a picture. He never did. And although he felt that it would be kind of skirting the issue to obviously try to avoid it.
Now, when you said that you would be glad to do that, okay, at what point would you say I won't be glad to do that?
I wouldn't have put a humping scene in this picture, even a comic one. I wouldn't have done that.
Although we have it in the dialogue.
We have plenty of humping in the dialogue, but that's a different story for me. I just wouldn't have liked to see somebody's bare ass kind of popping up or over the couch or any of those kind of things.
Actually, even at that, there was a very clever joke in terms of filming the after scene of Making Love. And you showed the shoes beside the bed. And, of course, obviously you were going to pan up to the bed and they were going to be lying there, luxuriating in each other's arms.
Right.
But they weren't there.
Right.
I'm glad you liked
that. That, to me, was a touch of almost genius.
Oh.
And then the camera starts wandering around looking for it.
Do you have the ad campaign that's on the picture?
Not yet. We've got trailers that are good. And we're stressing energy in the campaign.
But is there a visual that they have in mind?
Several that we're testing and stuff, fiddling around with.
When I told someone I was coming to see the picture, they said, "Oh, I saw it. It's just terrible." They confused it with visiting hours.
Oh no! Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think that it's a horror film
because Stephen King.
Yeah.
We had to clear that title. Yeah. Obviously, we had, but. Somebody owned it.
Well, I was thinking of the other title, Working Stiffs, which you worked on in
right.
TV.
Yeah.
Was that a title that anybody had ever considered? That's a perfect title.
No. It was always Night Shift.
Yeah.
It was always Night Shift. And that was Brian's title from the beginning. Because I think we ought to call the picture Night Shift, and we always liked it as a title.
But I'd like to go back to that point about shooting that the aftermath of the sex scene. I just think that you were trying to play with some of the conventions of shooting sex in a movie.
Initially, what I wanted to do was I wanted to do the cliche. I wanted to have them like fall on the floor and pan off to something, do a slow dissolve, and then I wanted to actually start in the living room and follow the clothes all the way to the bedroom. And then they're not there. And they were going to be there. That was the initial idea. Mm-hmm. And then I was talking about it and thinking about it, describing the shot, and suddenly the idea came, well, that's what you really expect. And I said, well, yeah, that's the cliche. That's what we're going for. Well, then what if we played the cliche all the way and then twisted it and put them somewhere else, outlandish, and they'd had that conversation on the street about aren't there different ways you'd like to do it? And it'd be pretty neat to see Chuck in a bathtub with a mink coat over him, you know? And so then, by the time we shot that scene, we realized we were running real long. So instead of following him from the living room, I just decided to start on the shoes and go up to the bed. But it was mostly to set people up for the cliche and then just twist it. And I wish I could say it was a comment on shooting sex, or, you know, but it
subconsciously it turns out that way.
I think it works well. It's kind of
profound and
it's another French.
Yes, put down that it is. That's there were just a few situations where I wanted to sort of take really traditional kinds of choices, like the overhead shot of the little girls beating Henry to a pulp. I just thought that was kind of neat that they were hitting him with cookies and pounding him down.
And also,
and we were doing this kind of slow zoom from straight over top, which was always kind of a...
And he's the one that gets the ice pack, really, instead of Shelley Long.
Yeah, that was a
reversal. But watching Henry Winkler go to work, too, you would expect that to be a transitional passage in a movie. Just mm-hmm. watch him go to work until suddenly you realize he's fighting the rush direction.
Yeah. You're right. I'm glad
that was really beautiful.
I'm glad you like that. Henry did a real good job of that physical stuff, making that play. Yeah. Worked out real good.
Well, let's talk about Winkler now, because as we did on the phone, we talked about how it's such a contrast to anything else he's ever done.
Yeah.
And he had to underplay absolutely everything, whereas, of course, the Fonz is deliberately overplaying
But
everything.
Is that really a contrast?
And
I don't see it as a contrast to that, sir.
Well, One and Only was still a guy who, his job in the movie was to sort of take stage and really be funny. I mean, he was mostly...
But the timidity of the character, some of that is...
He had some moments in One and Only where he hit that, and I agree, and mm-hmm. and in Heroes also.
But here's the whole thrust of the film.
Catherine, he was kind of frenetic, though, and, you know, I mean, he did have the moments. Yeah. He's never been in a situation where his job... was to string those moments together and kind of hold himself at that level. And I think that's probably what the challenge was for him. And also to then be in scenes with a guy who is doing what he normally does, which is take stage. And in essence, I mean, at one time Henry said, gee, I'm doing you here. And sometimes he would even say, you know, how should I handle this? And at the same time, the thing that I'm the proudest of is probably the laughs that he gets, particularly when we've run the picture out of L.A. When we ran previews in San Diego and up north, and they are with him from the minute he comes on screen, and there's never that moment of, gee, this isn't the Fonz, I'm disappointed. Mm-hmm. Yet they like it when he yells at the dog and gives them that little taste of the Fonz, you know. But they are, from his very first line where he says hello to her, that gets a little chuckle and they're right into his character, and I'm real, real pleased with that.
The long association you've had with him, can we assume that is really feeding into this picture now?
Oh, yeah.
The intimacy between you two?
Yeah, although, you know, it's always... there's always some concern when you go into that kind of a situation and you're working with a very close friend that the friendship may actually be in jeopardy, because it's a very important picture for both of us. We both want the movie to do well. We wanted to do a good job. And we're both pretty opinionated characters, you know. And my job now in working with Henry is different than my job was when we were acting together. Now I have to sort of be a leader. I have to go up and say, gee, Henry, I don't think that's a good choice. Why don't you try something else? Which we didn't work that way together. Some acting teams direct each other. We didn't do that, ever. We supported each other. And so I was a little bit concerned about that. But he made himself absolutely open, absolutely available. I mean, you could just see him bending over backwards to try anything that I suggested. And then we would discuss it from there. I mean, you want actors to speak up. You want them to say, gee, this is uncomfortable for me, or I got another idea, how about this? What you want as a director is that ultimately, once you've seen all the possibilities, and you say, no, I think it's this one, that's what gets executed.
As a director, are you ever going to, work with kids in a movie? I mean, obviously you would be very well qualified to work with a child on a set, I would think.
I worked with kids in a TV movie, which didn't turn out to be a very good TV movie, but I enjoyed working with the kids. It was fun. I would like to. I'm a little scared to do that right now.
Really?
I'm afraid that all I would need to do is make a good kid picture, and that'd be all I'd be doing for the next 10 years. And I would really like to make a couple of successful adult pictures that would then afford me the flexibility of being able to go and do a kid picture, because I love kids. I still feel a lot like a kid. I love sports.
Need a good baseball picture.
We
too,
sure do.
We really do.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been developing one, and we've been having trouble with the script. It's very, very hard. But aside from that, it's very hard to sell a baseball picture.
Oh, yeah. Really?
But one of my goals is to make a realistic baseball picture, because those guys never look like they can play, and it never looks real in the locker room.
Have you seen any reruns lately of Reagan pitching and the Cleveland Alexander story? Oh, Lord.
Well, I've had an opportunity to spend some time with, I even got to go down into the Expos dugout and spend some time in there. They put me in uniform for pregame because I know Billy DeMars, and I was the batting coach for the Expos. And I've been able to spend some time around major league locker rooms, and it's a real interesting place. And yet you could do the movie, and you wouldn't have to be as crazed or as sleazy as North Dallas 40 was to still be true and honest with it, because...
Or as painful as Bang the Drum Slowly.
Right, right. You could do kind of I wouldn't quite call it a comedy, but you could do a picture and it'd be a real entertaining, uplifting kind of picture.
Well, even kind of a fantasy. Have you ever read the Professional Baseball Association of a man who evolves a baseball game, a board game, and he gets absorbed into the action. And he becomes a character.
Really? No.
In the game. It's,
no. Yeah. No, I haven't.
It's a pretty frightening book. Yeah. But there's so many ways many directions you can go with a subject like that.
Well, baseball has a way of always being treated as fantasy. You know, like, did they shoot The Scout? Was that a Warner Brothers picture, The Scout? Peter Falk?
It's never been made.
It hasn't been made yet. I kept hearing that it was going to be made, and it was going to be made.
No, it's been sort of the last 4 years.
Ah. And then... Then for a while, Belushi was going to do a baseball picture, and then he was going to maybe be Babe Ruth or something. or reincarnation of Babe Ruth. And
someone who's got a Ty Cobb script.
Oh, my goodness.
Really?
Yeah.
It kind of keeps... That's another thing I've tried. I've tried the historical approach to baseball. Cap Anson and some of those characters. But I don't know. It's because baseball is not an international game. It makes it very difficult. Just Japan. And South America are the only places you could sell. And Japan's a big market, and South America's okay. But you're kind of writing off Europe. And they don't want to do that, which makes sense.
I never thought of that sort of consideration as a baseball.
Well,
of course it makes sense. Yeah.
With Bad News Bears in Europe, they had an intro explaining the game.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
just a very brief sort of intro, you know, what baseball was. And the only place they didn't run it outside of North America was Japan, but they didn't have it.
Yeah, interesting.
There's an interesting play called Ain't... Have you seen Ain't Lucky? It's about, you know, black teen that's touring Canada. It's a stage play. Mm-hmm. And one of their players gets sick, and so they get this, you know, young farm boy.
Who's white.
Yeah.
And they have, right. Yeah, I've heard about that. I've heard about that. Yeah, that's interesting.
And it works on stage. It's very strange, but it works on stage. Never works.
Do they do baseball? Do they play game? I mean...
Yeah.
Do they throw a ball, or is it all imaginary?
Oh, no, they throw a ball.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult.
Yeah, it must be. Because if you drop the ball, it goes flying out of the house.
Like
a souvenir.
Did you have much time growing up to play ball yourself, Mike?
Yeah, I did. My folks made sure that I did. And then the Andy Griffith Show people, I think they actually encouraged it, because the whole idea with Opie always was that he was really this fairly rough and tumble kid. And they liked that I knew how to throw a ball. And they, you know, and didn't look weird doing it.
Did you like the SCTV parodies of the
It was great. It was just great. I love that. I thought that was hysterical. I just wish that somebody would have done me instead of getting a little kid. I was the only thing I was disappointed in. But my God, Eugene Levy's Floyd is just mind-blowing.
Yes, yes.
Just incredible. And John Candy as Otis is great. And I also like the idea that they don't really try to do Andy, but that they let it be Merv. You know, I mean, they do. You know, they come on and it's the Merv Griffith Show, because everybody always call him Andy Griffin. So, and that's something that somebody caught on to there, and they played off that.
Where were a lot of those?
In Fred Travellino's.
As Jim there.
A lot of those rural locations. What part of California were those?
Culver City. We never left Culver City.
Amazing.
We were in Hollywood at Desilu, Cahuenga, and then we went to Culver City. The back lot was called 40 Acres. It's since been torn down. It's where they did Gone with the Wind. And I guess it had been sort of the back lot for Selznick. Great little place. And they had the real McCoy's little house there. And they had a town, which was... They had a western town, which we never used, but Mayberry was right there. Went out there every Monday for 8 years to go out and shoot a half a day's work or so. And the lake was a water reservoir that you never could... You know, like when I threw the rock in? I had to get special permission to do that because it was drinking water. And it's just right in the middle of Beverly Hills. It's a cold water. It's right on the edge of Beverly Hills. So we never got to go anywhere. Everybody... Danny Thomas Show and I Spy, all of Sheldon Leonard's shows, they were always going somewhere, you know, always going to Europe or someplace. And Andy was always bugging Sheldon about that. Finally, Andy came in one day, said, "Well, this is it. I sold Sheldon on the idea. We're going to make a trip this year." "Where, where, where?" "Andy's going to Hollywood."
Wow.
So that was our big trip.
And you actually shot in Hollywood.
Yeah, we shot on Sunset Boulevard on the bus.
Well, that sense of rural locale, though, was amazing. I really thought maybe it had been shot somewhere out of state.
I've never even been to North Carolina. But I think a lot of it has to do, you know, Andy really policed that stuff and really made things look right, and, you know. And Don, too. But Andy took a really active role.
Do you see Andy and hear from him?
I hear from him once in a while. I talk to him. I kind of bump into him, but we don't, you know, it's like every 9 months or a year or something.
There are no plans, you know, as they've resurrected, you know, leave it to Beaver and
Father. Seems like too many
best.
People are gone.
Well, to tell you the truth, there were plans, and there was a lot of enthusiasm, and I was all for it. I'd just be glad to do it. And Andy vetoed it, which is probably a wise thing, really. I just would have liked to have done it.
Well, let's follow up the thing about shooting right there in Culver City. Have you ever had a project, though, where you've had to do a lot of second unit work or a lot of location work out of here?
Oh, well,
did that on Night Shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went to New York.
New York.
We went to New York, although we did a lot on the stage in Night Shift. But most of my directing has been on location. I prefer directing on location. I don't really like working in town very much.
But isn't that a hassle of roping off streets?
Yeah, but it's exciting, and it has residual benefits that are a great, I mean, really, really valuable. For example, if you really were out working on a street, there's an excitement there, and it just infuses the scene with a little sense of reality, which is just missing. Things get too careful or too flat or something on a stage, I think.
Yeah.
And
I love it as a viewer, but I would think as a director,
it's you know, it is a hassle. It's limiting. And for example, a thing like the morgue, we had to build that. You know, I mean, you couldn't go and shoot in a real morgue for We had to take walls out and do stuff and dolly shots and things that you could just never do in order to keep that place interesting and keep any kind of movement going for, and we were in there 50 pages. But I really like going on location, and I'm willing to give up a lot in order to go on location. And also, really brings together your cast, because they can't call you up and, like, you know, get you to go on the Merv Griffin show that night. Instead, chances are you're going to go have dinner with somebody else in the cast, or look at your script or something.
What is your shoot? The short story, the racing story.
What, the Grand Theft Auto? Or
No.
Oh, the PBS.
Yeah.
That was shot in Santa Rosa, California. Beautiful, beautiful country. It was really nice.
On Night Shift, did you have any unusual incidents shooting on the streets? Because it struck me in the last scene, when the credits start to roll, that Billy Blaze is going around and talking up people who are total strangers on the street, and they're looking at him as if he's crazy.
Strange.
I just love it. It was just a nice way. Yeah, it was great.
Well,
it was a nice way to end it. So.
It worked out well, but those were all extras.
Well, they were.
Yeah, because we had a big crane and everything, and, you know, people would have looked at the camera.
I hate to think of the saxophone player in the subway as being somebody from Central Casting, but I guess maybe he was.
He was.
He just looked so...
He was terrific, wasn't he?
Yeah. Wow.
He was great.
I swear I've seen him several times.
I would have written him a check just to get rid of him.
We had some...
The talent is in the New York subway.
A lot of talent. That was we had one person who did you catch Cheryl and me in the movie?
Yeah.
Did you see? Well, my wife Cheryl is in every movie that I've ever done.
See, we were looking for a trademark.
That's my lucky cap that Bob Cotton gave me. Right. Well, I don't like to do that, but I wasn't going to let anybody else. That was the only way I could figure out to get Cheryl in the picture, and I didn't want anybody else to kiss me. I did it. But I always have to pick a shot that I don't think I'm going to cut. And she's done little parts and things and some of the stuff. But when we did that scene, Henry opened up the door there, and almost like the guy who slams him against the wall, you know, some guy came running right through there and just pushed him out of the way and, "Get the hell out of my way, buddy!" Kind of stood and stared at the camera for a second and then kind of went weaving off, and we were getting little things like that. Also, it was his neighborhood. People were always coming up. Little Jewish ladies would like come up in the middle of scenes and stuff. Henry, it's been so long since I've seen you. things like that.
Why don't you ever come over to the shop?
So we had some of that kind of thing. And we had one at that barber shop. If you ever look, the windows are real frosted over. And it's because we didn't have security enough to keep people, and they're just looking in the windows. And finally, we had no way to do it. And no matter what we pleaded, no matter what we did, they just tore ropes down. We were in this little, I think it was Queens, and they heard that Henry was there from a rehearsal that we'd gone to, and they were just going nuts. And so finally we just frosted in the
There was an incident, he did a film in Canada. There was an incident where, you know, there were all these throngs, you know, going out to the location, and they thought his double was him.
Right.
And so his double got mobbed.
Yep.
The work, though, with Shelley Long and Michael Keith, I think it's just superb.
Oh, thank
Those
you.
Two are such
they're kind of fine, aren't they?
Presences.
Yeah.
I keep saying new.
Well, they're new, and
then really got something there with those two.
Yeah, they're terrific. They're terrific. Well, we with Shelley, she was easy to find. Very early on, we found her and signed her. And Michael, we looked and looked and looked and tested, and videotaped and.
Stuff like his Rolling Stones thing. Was that his contribution?
No, that was in the script.
Jumping Jack Flash.
Everything. 90%. What he did was like him shooting jump shots and from the corner, and all his execution of those kind of things. I mean, that was his. But he brought a kind of a contemporary. Really, his idea was that this guy kind of wanted to be black. He thought that being black was cooler, and he loved the NBA, loved NBA basketball, and Bruce Springsteen. And I don't think that the writers...
Unknown black Bruce Springsteen.
Well,
like Buddy Holly. Yeah.
You want to be Bruce Springsteen and Walt Frazier, kind of at the same time, if you could. Just a street kid who's likes the contemporary kind of pop culture. How am I doing? Hipper and glibber and more of a contrast. What do you
think?
Sounds
like a double play combination, hipper to glibber to.
Hipper to glibber. We have to move you on now. We've got a line.